admission is by donation. That's 6 to 9 p.m. at the Friendly House at 1737 Northwest 26th Avenue. Coming up next, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher hosts a panel discussion with presenters from the Mathematics Education and Society Conference, a biennial international conference being held this week at Portland State University, exploring social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics education. Sounds kind of interesting. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
It's that time again. Time for another three-day community festival at Good in the Hood 2015, which is sure to bring even more than before. Starting June 26th through June 28th at Lil's Albina Park, there will be a celebration of community with live music, kid space, lots of local foods, and a chance for health screening too. KBOO is also in the Good in the Hood parade, and we want our members and volunteers to participate. For more information, contact Ani Haynes at volunteer@kboo.org. Again, Good in the Hood, Friday, June 26th through Sunday, June 28th. And KBOO will be broadcasting live on Saturday, June 27th. See you in the hood.
I know it's a lot of bad out there, but guess what?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. On this hot July day, speaking with some very interesting guests who have been attending an international meeting at Portland State University on mathematics, education, and society. For all of you who, like myself, remember high school algebra with memories of a test, distress, and concern, these are the people I would have liked to have had involved in my math education. Before I introduce you to them, I have a saying on my desk at home: people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. These folks have dedicated their lives and careers to helping us learn how to care more about math. MES is an organization that provides a forum for discussing social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics in education. The first meeting took place in Nottingham, England in 1998. Subsequent meetings have taken place in Europe, Australia, South America, and now Portland State. I'm so pleased to have with us people who have taken this on and are represented at Portland State as we speak for their organizational meeting. I'm going to start with Mr. D'Ambrosio.
Yes.
And have you give us a little of, first of all, your beautiful name that I didn't want to massacre. So if you give us your name and maybe just a small background, and I'll fill in.
Yes, my name is Ubiratan D'Ambrosio. Ubiratan is a name of a Indian, native Indian Amazonian root of the Guarani tribe that became popular in literature. And my father, as a son of an immigrant from Italy, the name D'Ambrosio is from Italy, and my father put the name from one of these novels about the Amazonian Indians, of the Guarani Indians. My brother called Ubira Jara, and my sister called Iara. The three names from the Indian literature. And it's difficult. Except in Brazil, everywhere in the world, they call me Ubi.
Yes.
And that's very easy.
And that is, well, I will refer
so
to you gladly.
Ubi da
Mosa. And you began, let me give our audience a little bit of background. He began his career as a mathematician in Brazil,
yes,
and the U.S. He progressively developed an interest in mathematics education reflected in his environment in the activities of the Inter-American Committee on Mathematics Education, of which he became president. He established worldwide connections and was elected vice president of the International Commission on Mathematics Instruction. This is the important part, and really I appreciate so much the capacity he helped found the African Mathematical Union and the African Society for the Advancement of Science subsequently has done a lot and won many awards in this field, bringing it out to many, many people.
That's it.
That's it?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty distinguished, and I'm very impressed. And next, we have Peter Gates. A little easier for me to explain. You're from England, and you were part of the establishment of MES8. So
yeah.
Tell us about that, Nottingham, England.
Yeah, well, welcome. Welcome from England.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a small number of colleagues, in particular myself and my colleague Tony Cotton. We worked together in Nottingham some while ago, and we felt there was a distinct lack of direct and public focus on the aspects of mathematics education that really help us to focus on caring for particular kids, the kids who suffer, the kids who don't get a good deal. And so we decided one day, we were sitting having a drink and decided, let's do something about it. And this was in 1996. And it took us 2 years to get the conference going. Luckily, a couple of days after we decided to set this up, we bumped into Ubi in Seville. And of course, he was the first person we wanted to get involved. So Ubi's been involved in the organization
right from the very start,
really. And it's now taken its own momentum. And with this conference, which has been extremely well organized, and the first time it's been in the Americas, by Brian and Schuppner. And so we've been around the world, and it just keeps going. And I think this has been an interesting conference because it's the one that's had more Americans at it, and that's been good. But I think it's been typified. We were talking on the way in what's the most important thing we'll take away from us, and I think for me it's about the emotions that have come out from people. We've got a huge number of academics and teachers who care, and that's what's the most important thing for us. They care about kids and they care about mathematics, and that I think comes through more in this conference than any other conference I've
been
to. Yes,
and to my opening quote, that's the piece that really matters, because you can know everything, but if there isn't that authenticity and that genuine care and concern, it certainly comes off that way. Well, and your colleagues to your left, Shopna, would you like to introduce yourself, and then your husband, Brian?
I'm Shopna Mukhopadhyay. I'm at Portland State University, and I'm one of the local organizers of MES8, the 8th Conference of Mathematics Education and Society, the first time happening in the Americas. So we are very proud to be the first host, and this is why perhaps we have a lot of people from the Americas. Both US, Canada, and Latin America join us this time.
And I'm Brian Greer. I'm also one of the organizers of MES8. I'm originally from Ireland, but I came to the States in 2000. I had been many times before, but it was permanently in 2000 in order to be with Shopna. And I've been working in mathematics education for a very long time, and coming to realize that, as the great educator Paulo Freire said, education is politics, and mathematics education is certainly politics.
Which is, I think, not generally accepted or understood, especially about mathematics. I think we are now finally entering a phase in which that might be true of science, and we have moved at least to understanding that. But it's still a new territory and a new explanation when it comes to math. I know that there's several other people that you have as speakers. And Shapna, I wonder if you could explain Munir.
Yes, let me explain or describe actually Munir Fasheh, who has just finished his morning presentation and made us all very reflective and emotional with his very powerful speech. He's from Palestine, as I said. Earlier in his life, he was at Harvard, and he's a mathematics educator. He looks at mathematics education the way we are looking at it now. From our own perspective through MES, it's about healing and reclaiming. It's healing our abuse that we get in formal institutional settings. Oftentimes, people don't feel they understand. They feel they're stupid. They're not smart enough. They're not good enough. And how do we reclaim that as who we are and how we connect to our, what he calls, grounding, to our roots?
A very interesting background. He was born in Jerusalem, Palestine, in 1941 and was driven out of his home with his family in 1948. And then he lives in Ramallah, or has, and then taught mathematics for many years. His biography talks about uprooting. And can you explain a little bit? I know that when he was 35 years old, he realized that he had actively helped in uprooting his mother's mathematics from his home and replacing it. And he goes on to explain some of that. Brian, do you want to?
Yes. Munir talks about his mother's mathematics. His mother, a typical day in her life would be that a woman would arrive with a piece of cloth. His mother would take some quick measurements. She would cut the cloth up into 37 pieces with minimal wastage, sew it together, and in the evening the customer would come back and have a fitted garment. And he had a kind of epiphany at one point where he realized that what his mother is doing when she does that is a kind of mathematics. Very different from the formal mathematics that he had learned at Harvard and other universities and that he was teaching. And again, I'm reminded of Paulo Freire, who said that the intellectual activity of those without power is always dismissed as being non-intellectual. And it's about what counts as intelligence, what counts as knowledge. And at one point this morning, he said, at a particular point in Palestine, he had to leave the university, and his family were uprooted again. The only person who had the skills to continue earning a living was his mother.
Yeah.
He could not go to the marketplace and say, I can do calculus, who will give me a job?
The skills of survival, the everyday, day in and day out, the appreciation, understanding, and necessity that people work through somehow gets distorted into not being as elevated and as important.
So this morning, Munir was also sharing that his mother is what we call typically illiterate. She took the measurements in different colored chalks, one color for the height, one color for the width. So they were her own coding system that she was using to get the job done, a very complex job of making clothing for others without the written formulas and algorithm, etc. So she was doing the mathematics without the conventional tools.
Can I add something to that? I mean, one of the other things that Munir said today, which was quite a challenging thing to say to a room full of mathematics teachers, was a child is born and starts to crawl, and he learns mathematics about his environment. He or she climbs a tree and learns mathematics about space and about trees and about science and so on. All their lives, children are learning mathematics until they go into a maths classroom and then stop. Now, I think the issue there, I think, is about the way in which a lot of us in our community are trying to redefine what mathematics is. And that's why we're really pleased to have Ubi here, because one of the things that Ubi's been talking about and been building up for decades has been the notion of ethnomathematics, and you might just want to
What his best known contribution to the field of mathematics. So explain to us, ethnomathematics, I can kind of understand from the word, but expand on that notion for us.
Yeah, so the idea came as a result of my personal and professional academic life. I started to as a mathematician, and I did research in pure mathematics, and I had experiences of going to teach pure mathematics in Africa, in a UNESCO project, in the United States, in Brazil, of course, and in all the countries of Latin America, in the OAS program. And this exposed me to very different cultural systems where my teaching of mathematics was the academic mathematics, Western mathematics, yeah, from the academia. But visiting other places, you start to talk with people, and I was always very interested in people. Talk with people and asking about their roots, their family life, their culture, and all this. And I realized that how rich is the culture of each individual, and how rich is the culture of the group. And this was absolutely ignored in teaching mathematics. Teaching mathematics was to transmit a knowledge that had nothing to do with the roots. And then I started to look at the roots, cultural roots, family roots. And I realized that in the roots, cultural roots, in the history of that community, of the history of the individual, there was much mathematics growing up from a different perspective than the one that we teach in the academia.
Yeah.
The academics mathematics comes as something very artificial. And the child, when the child goes from home to school, it's like going to another world, completely different world. And this school forces, in a sense, through, there are several ways of doing this, this school forces to, the message is, forget what you know. Forget you what you bring from your roots, from your family, from your... We'll now teach you the truth, what's correct, what's the facts. And there is a cognitive rupture for a child. And this is true not only for a child, in all the ages. If you don't respect what was before, built from the roots, from the... And you say, no, this is not important. Important is what I will tell you. This brings a cognitive rupture.
Yeah.
And not only a cognitive rupture, but an emotionally and moral rupture. So the people starts to work, think, and reflect and put his mind in favor of an ethics of precision that is brought from the academic Western mathematics, and forgets about a broad ethics of life, of respect for the others, of respect for the environment, of solidarity, of cooperation, that this comes from the roots. Mathematics is cold about this. It's yes. only a set of rules, of forms, of norms. And I think this is really very dangerous in preparing new generations, because they only will look for the ethics of the precision and rigor associated with mathematics.
Yeah.
So the entire idea is to talk about a mathematical, an ethics of mathematics,
yes.
broader ethics.
Well, and again, one of the people that was on the panel was Bob Peterson, to your point. He's a teacher, union activist, writer, community organizer, and he's taught mathematics from 10 and 11 years old for over 30 years as a bilingual fifth grade teacher. I thought this was interesting in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin public schools. His mathematical teachings were focused on ensuring that it is grounded in students' lives, as you said, that it's based on social justice, and most importantly, that it integrates the curriculum rather than separates, yeah. that it shows a way to expand and go forward. And that's, Peter, that's kind of what this forum is about, to expand to people, educators in particular, but they go out in the world informed differently about the teaching of mathematics.
I think it's also about trying to use mathematics to create an opportunity to help children in the state system to understand their world a bit better. So teachers always have choices about what materials and resources they use, and one of the things that Bob, I think, highlighted quite well to the community and to the in his talk was that teachers can make choices that actually turn kids around and make them understand the world a bit better. So he had a number of activities that helped them understand how wealth is distributed across the world, how the population is distributed around the world.
Could there be more important mathematics than that? Mm-hmm. And again, before I came in, one of the people that I was speaking to said, well, the important mathematics here are our relationship to the rest of the world and the distribution and money and economics. And of course that has to be important. It almost by design has to be disincentivized to not have it be important, like you said, because in the real world, you would be.
Well, there are other important issues, I guess. I mean, there's climate change, for example.
Exactly.
And if we don't educate a generation to think carefully and judge what damage we're doing to the environment, then there's no point thinking about teaching, because there'll be nobody to teach, because there'll be nothing, you know, there'll be nothing here. We're facing a catastrophe. So I think it's important that we understand that. But it's also important that kids understand not just, you know, the distribution of wealth and so on, but for example, examples of how race is distributed, how race is faced differently by different people. And some nice examples he had was who gets stopped by the police more often than others. And that was a nice example of children doing work around their community to explore, are people's experiences a bit different? Because one of the things mathematics allows us to do is to understand the world. And by understanding the world, to quote one of our other speakers, Olius Cobbs-Mosey, it allows you to change the world. And so I would say, if we had to say one thing that we would all agree in this conference, was that what we want to do is a small thing. We just want to change the world.
Yeah. And in using math as a background for this, it's just fascinating. I want to remind our listeners that this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, and I'm speaking to a group of people who are here in this very important mission of mathematics, education, and society, MES8, because this is an ongoing forum. And I think there's a website, there's several. Peter, can I ask you to give us the website that people can go to?
Yeah, at the moment, it's a website that really is mainly for people to pick up the materials and the papers that we've written. So it's not a website that I would say was a public website that people can find out lots more. It's mainly about the materials that we've produced, although that's an ongoing, that's the next phase of development that we're looking at, what role that that particular website can play.
And I also, there was a website that was available that I went to that was talking about the ethical responsibilities of mathematicians and mathematics educators in expressing in writing non-killing mathematics, which was fabulous. So I could that.
Yeah. I have been I work much in history of mathematics, the history of science, history of ideas in general.
That's a lovely
and
way to put it.
Yeah, from the very beginning of the human species, from the paleo era.
Just information in general,
yes,
curiosity
from the very,
in the
very
beginning. Yeah.
And my views of history is to look at the evolution of mathematics in from this hominid, from the beginning of the human species, the evolution of mathematical ideas and how they are the result of cultural encounters. Because, you know, people have always been moving around and they encounter each other. Of course, when they encounter, there may be conflict, maybe wars, maybe, but there is always some exchange of ideas. And this is what produces ideas that are spread all over the world. And in most of the moments of the history, you see that mathematics has been the most important instrument to build up destruction strategies. Weapons and economics, that's terrible. Politics, and the mathematics has been used as a very efficient strategy for killing in the broad sense.
Right.
Not only taking life,
but the destruction.
Taking the dignity of the individual. This is very serious. So, I'm part of a group for non-killing knowledge in general, where we can, if this mathematics was so efficient, so important in developing strategies for killing, it should also be efficient in developing strategies for survival, for
That's
no
right.
killing.
That's right.
And this is the theme that I call, in general, non-killing, but in my case, non-killing mathematics. Look for a direction of mathematics that would not result in killing, but result in cooperation, solidarity, and building up civilization with dignity for all.
So I think most people would be surprised. Now, Shapna, first of all, Portland State.
Yes.
I need, since I have a friend who's affiliated with Portland State, and she said, wow. So why Portland State? Is it because of your involvement?
Yes, I'm a faculty member at Graduate School of Education. So this is why Graduate School of Education is the local host, and Portland State University is really supporting us in hosting this grand adventure of bringing mathematics education and society to the Americas.
So, and Peter, and Brian, and Uwe, it must be interesting to be invited to dinner. Do most people go, good heavens, what are we going to talk about, or how is this going to be? Or are you finding that there is now a movement out of the classroom where people come and they are encouraged by what you've presented and they see the broader picture of how, I'm thinking in my mind of a sophomore high school teacher who's feeling kind of isolated and alone and has books that he's open to and a class that he's got to prepare for. Is because of the internet and because of your movement,
what we try to do in all the conferences is to involve teachers wherever the conference happens to take place. Mm-hmm. It's happened in various countries, and the local organizers do what they can to organize, to publicize, but to organize and to engage teachers. And I think Brian and Shapner have done very well on that. They might want to say something about how mm-hmm. they've managed that.
Well, we work quite extensively with teachers, but there is a major structural problem, which is to do with both the structure of the educational system in the States and what is happening right now with the Common Core State Standards, mm-hmm. and even more particularly the pathological amount of standardized testing that is happening, which is having it's hard to exaggerate the detrimental effect that is having on education. There is also a background problem, which is that the characterization of mathematics in the public at large and among politicians and other groups is that mathematics is neutral, politically neutral. It's mathematics is the same everywhere in the world. It is abstract. It has no history. It's a very moribund notion of what mathematics is. We start from the position that mathematics is a human activity, which is often contrasted with what is called the Platonic view, which is that mathematics is independent of human beings yeah. and timeless.
Do you think, I should ask, I'm starting to see that change. Around the edges, I'm starting to see the lines blur as people understand that these boxes, these truncated small pieces in every field, in sociology and history, like you said, Ubi, yeah. that you almost can't think about history, think about the civilizations, think about cultures without broadening out to see mathematics as an integral part of that. Do you think that the community of mathematicians are starting to embrace Shapna?
Before I address the if the mathematicians are warming up to that, let's say what's happening in classrooms, because that's where our reach is. And the classroom teachers are making an impact. And one of the presenters in this conference was a local high school teacher. She teaches at one of the alternative high schools, and she's doing very innovative curriculum on what stays in the intersection of mathematics and social context and cultural context. And she brought one of her students to talk about what they are learning. So this is not just what she was reporting, but this is a student voicing what they are learning. So that's where I think that our reach is, that the younger generation seeing mathematics differently, more broadly, more widely, and seeing the human connection, the cultural connection, and their feeling that adds to their identity.
I noticed that there was tweets online. So, I mean, clearly you are right in that there are people who are now receiving this information and being aware, and to your point, Brian, the language, and being aware that, first of all, to dispel the notion that it was ever neutral, that it was ever without a cause or a purpose, is an important part that we have now all come to after, in terms of education anyway, to think that somebody standing in front of a classroom didn't have an opinion, what to say, what to leave out, how important that is.
Well, I cannot say everybody is on board, but people are at least pausing on their way and making people aware of the cultural and social and political connections of mathematics is happening.
Yeah, yeah. And do you also think that as the, the social demographics change and new people come in that are exposed to so many more cultures, the shift that we've seen in the last 30 years, and every time I bemoan the fact that we're not there, that we haven't come far enough, fast enough, I only need to look around and at my own sons and see that it's been a dramatic an important change. Again, I want to let our listeners know that I'm speaking with people from the Conference of MESA, and they have been in town. It's Mathematics, Education, and Society. They've been in town for a conference at Portland State. Thanks to Shapna, who has been instrumental, a professor at Portland State, Brian, her husband, Peter, and Ubi. I can't thank you enough. I wanted to know, is there anything else that I didn't cover that you want the opportunity to let our listeners know? And we'll be watching your future.
I think I'd like to speak on behalf of the whole community, and while we've got the local community listening, just to thank Brian and Shapna for taking on this conference, because 2 years ago they offered to run a conference and I'm sure they didn't know what they were taking on. And it's not easy organising a conference with a bunch of academics from around the world. It has been tremendous. Okay, we've had glitches, but I mean to organise a conference like that where people are staying in, one of the things we do is always stay in the same place, so we're all together, we eat breakfast together, we eat dinner together and we stay together, and it's gone remarkably well, and I think they're done a fantastic job, and I want to thank them on behalf of the whole community.
And I think that being in communion and, like you say, coming all together.
Yeah. And I want to also say something like Peter said. It was really a big achievement to have this conference, and we are very thankful to Brian and Swapna for having organized such a broad group of people from different places of the world, different perspectives, and this makes this conference really a remarkable one. Was an excellent experience, an excellent opportunity for creativity, for challenge, and we surely will go home. I'll go far home to Brazil. We go home with much stimulus to continue to think about this major topic, and that's the relations between mathematics education and society.
Wow.
And one thing our people have said is just how wonderful the people of Portland are. And what they've experienced, being lost, standing in a street with a map in your hand, to have people come up to you and ask if they can help. And everywhere we've been, the people here have been tremendous.
Fabulous. Well, if I'd have found you earlier, I would have had some math questions. You could have allayed my fears. I want to thank you all. Brian?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you to KBOO.
Oh.
On behalf of the people who are here, the people at the conference and the wider community, thank you to KBOO for the wonderful job that you do.
And all the work that you are doing, and we know you will be doing in future. We are all together with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, again, I want to thank all of our guests for sharing this important topic. We are going to be following your good work. We are glad you are out in the world with all your effort and energy, time and commitment. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Thanks for listening.
The KBOO Friday Radio Zine continues. Stay tuned.
I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Naomi Prince, who's an author, journalist, and a senior fellow at Demos Think Tank. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Prince.
Thank you very much.
And your excerpts from your book are available at The Huffington Post and at Tom Dispatch, and largely covering Jeb Bush's entrance and the Bush dynasty's connections to Wall Street. But in a broader context, it seems that recent decades that the locus of power in the United States has shifted away from Washington to Wall Street. Obviously, there's always been power on Wall Street, but my understanding is throughout most of America's history, the power of Washington has always trumped the power of Wall Street. But has that relationship changed, do you think, in recent decades?
It certainly has. And as you say, there has been a lot more of a strengthening of power. power coming from Wall Street in the last year, since really the 80s through today, and that's accelerated. But that was also actually apparent in the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s through the 1929 crash. There was also a strengthening of Wall Street relative to Washington. And in between the years, between the 30s through the end of the 70s, it was a little bit more balanced. It wasn't that Wall Street had no part of Washington. It always has. Particularly in the last 130 years or so of American history, before which there was a lot of other banks in different parts of the country also having influence with presidents. But it's just become much stronger in the recent decades because of two reasons. One is because Wall Street in general has become much less regulated, and the larger companies that control Wall Street are more concentrated in terms of the power and capital that they can influence and the individuals that do so. And also because there's been a lot of appointments of Wall Street CEOs into one of the most important positions in Washington, which is the Treasury Secretary position with respect to money, and of course many others as well. So there's just been a lot more going back and forth between Washington and Wall Street more recently. There's been much more money required to get people elected in the last decades as well. So that's also come into play. Wall Street has the money and the influence and also is able to, you know, use it as it sees fit. But that said, presidents want it. This is a two-way street. This is not an imposition. This is an embrace.
Well, given that we're in the presidential season and that Jeb Bush is considered by many to be the Republican front runner, there is a clear dynastic history, is there not, with the Bush family, not just in American politics, but also on Wall Street, going back to Jeb Bush's grandfather.
Yeah, no, that's right. His great-grandfather, George H.W. Bush, ran an investment bank in New York on Wall Street named after him, which was eventually taken over by Merrill Lynch, which was a very powerful brokerage, and it still is, but in a component now of Bank of America, which wound up acquiring Merrill Lynch in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, not least because of some of those legacy Bush ties. And so there's really been over 100-and-something years of development throughout the larger Wall Street, or some of the largest Wall Street banks, into a couple of the big six